Welcome to the Oster Show of Entrepreneurship and Regional Development Podcast. Each publication in our journal is a great opportunity to share significant and audacious contributions to large regions. My guest today is Marie-Joy Baloyo from Manchester Metropolitan University. She recently published an article entitled, "They Don't Waste Money on Women, Gendered Entrepreneurial Household Dynamics and the Total Social Organization of Labor." She co-authored this paper with Sally Jones. It has been published in Entrepreneurship and Regional Development, a journal edited by Taylor & Francie. Marie-Joy, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much, Vincent. And yes, so first of all, just a quick introduction about myself. My name is Marie-Joy Baloyo, an academic wearing simultaneous hats, a lecturer, as well as a dedicated researcher within the Department of Strategy, Enterprise and Sustainability Department at Manchester Metropolitan University, so here in the UK. My biggest professional kind of passion centers on this vital question of our time around, you know, what does decent work and productivity look like? How do we reveal the ongoing inequalities in this division of labor? You know, what does good look like, you know, for you, for me? And so I believe that this conversation that we're about to have is going to be a critical one, especially creating this transparency around, you know, around division of labor. So, yeah, I am truly grateful for entrepreneurship and regional development for giving me this powerful opportunity to be able to speak about the piece of research that I'm very passionate about, to be given a voice and also a platform for others to listen. Because I believe that it's invaluable having that kind of, my hope is that this message lands on people's ears, especially individuals such as entrepreneurs, managers, policymakers, who can reflect on the structural inequalities that we try to expose, to challenge each one of us to make a difference, no matter how big or small, in how we value labor and how we would be, you know, try to create this more equitable entrepreneurial future that we want.
Can you tell us, what is the origin of your paper? Why have you decided to address this particular topic? And what is the question you aim to answer?
Yeah, so this is a very good question, Vincent, especially for us to start off with. So this research actually came about from a contradiction that I kept encountering in the world. So let me try to share with you some of my experiences. So one day I was interviewing entrepreneurs. So entrepreneurs, people we would call, typically call the successful business owners, right? And they talk about their journey. They would talk about their risk, their decision making. But then I'd be invited in their homes and their businesses, and I would see their wives or even their partners doing the book. Managing the decision-making or trying to do the customer calls or trying to manage the business schedules that they have. Yet when I'd ask them about this, it would often be dismissed as just helping out or, you know, their response in terms of she's only doing this and the side when she has time. So going back to your question, the origin of this research really came from observing this contradiction in the field regarding how labor is recognized within the entrepreneurial settings. We noted that while we interview entrepreneurs about their business, their wives or their partners are often performing substantial critical work that is frequently dismissed as just casual help. So a prime example of this problem with recognition is highlighted by one of our participants. We called her Sharon. So Sharon had worked in her husband's, James's business for approximately 25 years. So she provided informal, unpaid labor by helping with tax returns and managing accounts, in addition to her voluntary work for the church, the resource center that they run, and also the nursery. However, James described Sharon's work simply as casual help. So talking with their son as well, they described her role as working behind the scenes. So crucially, no one really knew what Sharon does. No one could clearly define her actual role in the business, including Sharon herself, right? So she was never clear about what she does, This highlighted a fundamental problem. The problem that her work was essential to business survival, yet it was invisible and devalued. So this context made us realize that the existing entrepreneurship literature, which discusses how household provides resource for ventures, often treats the household as a neutral space, right? So we recognize a critical gap here, which is that research was not sufficiently exploring whose labor is being mobilized to under what conditions and what are the inherent gendered patterns. So we argue that the household is, in fact, the arena where entrepreneurial activities are deeply embedded. So therefore, this led us to our central research question, which is how do gendered household dynamics influence the organization of labor in entrepreneurial households? So we used Glucksmann's total social organization of labor theory, which allowed us to analyze work as a diverse array of practices, recognizing all forms of work as interconnected rather than separate spheres. So thereby foregrounding the household as our units of analysis. Perhaps just to clarify with you, Vincent, in that what we mean by all forms of work here is the paid and the unpaid, as well as the formal and informal work. And these are interconnected as opposed to being separate.
What are the main contributions of this paper?
You know what? I'm glad you asked this question. And while I was writing this paper, I remember vividly sitting down in our dining table, asking for hours and hours and thinking over and over again what our main contribution is. You know, what is our main contribution to entrepreneurship and regional development itself? So that, you know, the golden question of the so what question, right? So I'll try my very best to articulate this. And for this podcast, I would like to highlight the three main contributions. So your empirical, theoretical, and also the practical contributions. So firstly, empirically, so we reveal a double standard in how household labor flows. What do I mean by this? So in our research, we show that when a business is owned by a man, women household members are expected to provide labor, even if they are not employees and have other jobs or careers. So for instance, so we have Irene. Irene is from Entrepreneur Household 3. So Irene provides informal unpaid labor by managing her partner's business tax receipts and custom service while caring for their newborn child. Another example is Jasmine. So Jasmine is from Household 4. So she is a nurse with a stable employment status, which enabled her husband to access loans to grow his business, requiring her to pick up extra bank jobs or extra bank shifts, like, for example, night shifts in the hospital, just to be able to supplement the sporadic household income that they had. However, on the other hand, when a business in the household is owned by a woman, the man in the household offers no support. So, for example, we have Faye. So Faye is from Entrepreneurial Household 5. Faye, who runs a mobile hairdressing business, receives no involvement or support from her partner, Niall. Niall even explicitly said, "I try to stay away from the business." So this asymmetry demonstrates that household support for entrepreneurship is deeply gendered, right? Second, so theoretically, we introduce the concept that many women become careerless despite years of substantive input and work. So in here, I'll try to use Sharon and Brenda's story from our paper. So first of all, with Sharon, so Sharon is from Entrepreneurial Household 2. Sharon had provided informal unpaid labor for James' business for approximately 25 years. Now with Brenda, so Brenda is from Entrepreneurial Household 1. Brenda had various jobs, but left to care for her children full time. So because of this work was informal, it wasn't paid, intermittent, or inextricably intertwined with domestic responsibilities, women like Sharon remained without recognized careers or experience. Brenda's situation illustrates this, as her earlier low-wage and unemployment after childbirth meant a lower retirement pension fund compared to her husband, and she currently receives little income from the business or pensions because she never had a long-term employment. This work, though critical to business survival, is obscured and not recognized as formal employment. This challenges how we conventionally understand work trajectories and career development in entrepreneurship contexts. And lastly, so the third one is practically. So our work shows that the conventional entrepreneurship success narrative obscures the underlying household system that makes ventures viable. So what I'm trying to say is that there is a problem. There is a problem with our continuous obsession and assumption that entrepreneurship is about the individual risk taker or the innovative founder. For example, when we celebrate James's construction business, such as the church that he runs, the nursery, and the resource center, we are also celebrating a household economic system that depends on the household unpaid labor. So in other words, James' success are interconnected and rely on the skills and the informal unpaid labor provided by Sharon, their children, and others as well. So we highlight the crucial, often unacknowledged role and influence of the broader household in the business survival. So fundamentally, we are arguing that you cannot understand entrepreneurship without understanding the gendered household dynamics. And what happens, what appears to be an individual venture is often a household extraction system. What we mean by this is that by the household extraction system is where women's labor is viewed as an untapped economic household resource and a reserve army, we call it. This has vital implications for how policies are designed to be more equitable and inclusive, to be able to support the entrepreneurial households.
What was for you the main theoretical or maybe methodological challenge or challenges in addressing such a question?
Not only is this question challenging, but for me, perhaps the biggest challenge was making visible what deliberately was kept invisible, right? So household labor, especially women's informal work, is structured to be taken for granted. It's called just helping out. It's what women do. It's what wives, what partners, what daughters, what female friends, it's what they do. You know, it's seen as this natural caregiving. So I will try to describe the challenges from a methodological as well as from a theoretical angle. So first of all, methodologically, we had to interview beyond the registered business owner. So if we had only interviewed James, we would have heard the standard entrepreneurship story. So a businessman who builds a successful construction or a community-based business. However, by interviewing Sharon and their children, daughter-in-laws, as well as family friend who lodges with them, so a completely different picture emerged. So this allowed us to view business not as James' individual venture, but as a household system that is mobilizing this multiple people's labor, their time, their resources as well. So this meant our case studies became quite complex. So in total, we had 17 participants across the 5 entrepreneurial households in the paper. So for household 2 alone, we interviewed 8 people, right? So this multiplicity of voices was essential because it gave us multiple perspectives on the same household dynamics and crucially revealed the contradictions that we're trying to unpack. So for instance, with James, James refers to Sharon's work in the business as casual help and doesn't have a clear idea of her role. In contrast, Sharon says she does everything, including sometimes acting as a psychiatrist. And even their sons, they describe her work as the grafter who works behind the scenes. So they describe her as this necessary glue that binds them together, right? So yeah, nobody clearly could define her actual role, could define what Sharon's role is. right? So now let's go to the theoretical challenge, which we encountered. And I believe for me, the main theoretical challenge was effectively trying to apply Glucksmann's theory. So trying to apply the total social organization of labor theory, or the TESOL, as we call it as well. So we used an abductive research design involving a systematic combination of induction as well as deduction to apply this theory to the case to the case data that we had. This framework was necessary to challenge the perception of entrepreneurial household as this neutral space, and also to be able to analyze how work is intertwined across formal, informal, and paid and unpaid practices to be able to capture that complex lived reality of the lives of these entrepreneurial households. We treated household work and business economic activities as a spectrum, right? What I mean by the spectrum is that it depended on the relativeness of whether it's formal to maybe more informal, from wholly unpaid through the wholly paid labor practices. Our reason for this is to be able to reveal the full extent of the labor that is involved. So by systematizing this fluid data and writing detailed narrative accounts or narrative cases, we were able to build a thick description of the phenomena. This was necessary for us to be able to capture the complexity of the life of the entrepreneurial households. And lastly, this allowed us to move beyond focusing on the individual entrepreneur for business, and instead to be able to foreground the household as the arena where entrepreneurial activities are deeply embedded.
During your research journey, what was your biggest surprise, or maybe the most counterintuitive result?
I saw this question, or I heard it before from one of your podcasts, and I was just thinking, right, this is such a hard question, and most of your questions are very value-laden, but it's necessary, right? So this is such a big question, and so let me try to take some time to try to dissect this, and hoping that our audience will be able to follow through as well, right? So first of all, honestly, the biggest surprise was the sheer invisibility of women's work, even to the women themselves. We expected to find unequal divisions of labor. We expected that women will be doing more unpaid work, right? So, but what I did not expect was the extent to which this work could not be named or formally articulated. The best way to describe this is through the lived experiences of our participants, and by the way, to whom I'm very indebted and very grateful for. So when I asked Sharon what she does, I'd sit then and ask her, what do you do? She responded, that's a good question. So I kind of do everything. Sometimes I might say psychiatrist, but I can't put my finger on exactly what I do. I guess just an overseer. So for me, this illustrates that someone managing accounts, overseeing facilities, and providing this emotional support could not define her own role. And even to her children, they also described her work as just behind the scenes. Similarly, with Irene, Irene is from our entrepreneurial household 3. So when I asked her the same question about her role, she said, I'm not even registered or a paid employee. So our life feels very floating. So for me, the term floating really captured my attention. It captured mine and Sally's attention because it, in a sense, this floating captures this sense of doing critical work that lacks formal recognition, that lacks stability, that lacks legitimacy. So this invisibility results in women remaining without recognized careers or experience despite their works of their years of substantive input, despite the years of the substantial work that they have done so far. Now, the counterintuitive part was this. The more integrated the household and business, the more invisible women's work became. You would think proximity would make it more visible because, you know, they're working side by side or it's all in the home. But actually, the blurred boundaries allowed work to be reframed as domestic duty, as wifely support, as family obligation, rather than economic labor. So in other words, you might assume that proximity would make it easier for us to see their work, to make their work more visible, but the blurred boundaries masks off the work practices within the entrepreneurial household, which neutralizes the influence of gendered household dynamics. And here's the really, really striking pattern of the systemic inequality, which is that invisibility only went one direction. So when men owned the business, women were expected to provide labor and informal support. However, when women owned the business, there was perfect clarity about their roles. So for example, with Faye, so Faye is from Entrepreneur Household 5. Faye is clearly a mobile hairdresser. Nobody was confused about what Faye does, but nobody expected her partner to help out, to give her support, right? So the invisibility only went one direction. And I feel as though I'm going to come out with a song now. But in a sense, you know, it just went one direction. And this reveals a potential double standard where men's primary obligation is seen as bringing in an income while women's time and support, you know, women's time and supportive work are undervalued and seen as an obligation to the household themselves. Now, this makes women an untapped economic household resource. And like I said before, this a reserve army of labor, which I've mentioned. So the other surprise, and I feel as though this was even darker to the extent of what I'd call the emotional coercion. So this emotional coercion manifested through deeply internalized gendered expectations that became self-enforcing constraints. So we observed instances where women performed essential informal work, not necessarily by free choice, but driven by a sense of familial obligation and the fear of jeopardizing the male's partner's venture. So for example, Irene, who was studying part-time and was the full-time carer for her newborn child, she provided informal unpaid labor and emotional support to her partner's music app business as well. Irene continued to help her partner out even after just giving birth, explaining that she didn't do it by choice, but because someone has to. Her motivation was driven by the fear that she would be the person that's hampering their project. So this fear prompted her to work against her will. And despite a lack of support, despite a lack of kind of this help or this emotional support from her partner, which resulted in her feeling of being resentful, being understood and feeling guilty most of the time whenever she tries to suggest a break. So, for example, going out or just having a cup of coffee, you know, just to simply go do something outside of work. This highlights how the pressure of the relationship and gendered household dynamics meant the business became both partners' responsibility, even though Irene's opinion was devalued and what she described as work that gets pushed to the bottom. This suggests that her role, despite its critical nature, was continuously constrained by the normative expectation that her partner's formal role as the business owner and also the breadwinner must be privileged. This structural inequality means women's supportive work is often viewed as the obligation to the household. Just a final point, this reveals how gender dynamics intertwined with familial duty and the emotional labor, rendering women vulnerable to coercion and exploitation, limiting their opportunities outside the household and resulting women remaining without recognized careers or recognized experience despite their years of substantive work. So the invisibility of this work allows it to be reframed as domestic duty or wifely support rather than economic labor.
What are the main implications of your work for entrepreneurs, managers, policymakers, practitioners in general?
Yes, so my response to this will have different implications for different actors, right? So the implications will vary depending on who you are in the system and also your own embedded context. So for business practitioners, such as advisors, or for those who give support to the entrepreneurs themselves, you need to ask who else is in the room. So when you're working with an entrepreneur, especially male entrepreneurs, try to map out the household labor explicitly. So when you're doing this, ask who's doing the books, who's enabling work during these hours. What happens if that person stops helping? Because if the business model depends on unpaid household labor and you're stress testing financials, you're missing a critical vulnerability that may cause the business to collapse if that person withdraws labor or demands compensation. So you need to continuously, and for me, have that iterative question to continually ask those critical questions, the who, the what, the when, and the how. So for example, when that labor needs to be formalized or paid, can the business sustain it? So when that person has had enough, when they decide to leave today, for example, can the business still continue? Can the business still survive? And also to recognize that women entrepreneurs face different household dynamics. Faye, for example, so with Faye couldn't take maternity leave. She couldn't afford childcare. She couldn't access time to upskill. This is not because of individual deficit, but because she had no household support. Your women's enterprise programs need to account for these structural constraints. Second one, so for policymakers, business support is currently targeted at registered owners who are disproportionately male. But the person doing customer service, managing accounts, enabling the owner's availability, they're not in your programs. They don't get the training, the networks, or the support needed. Yet if they withdraw labor, the business will fail. So we need to design a moral, political, and ethical policies. For example, a more equitable and inclusive policies. For instance, let's consider the story of Jasmine. So Jasmine, again, like I said, she's from Entrepreneurial Household 4. She's a registered nurse. Her stable nursing salary and employment status enabled her husband to access business loans. So policymakers should assess whose creditworthiness actually enables the loan, right? So furthermore, we must question whether informal business work, like the one performed by Sharon for 25 years, they should qualify for pension credits, similar to caregiving. So the invisibility of marginalized women's labor is exacerbated during times of crisis, further entrenching structural inequality. So perhaps policymakers can start with these two questions to consider. So first one, should informal business work qualify for pension credits the way caregiving does? And second, should business loan assessment account for whose creditworthiness is actually enabling the loan? Now, for entrepreneurs themselves, especially couples, especially partners who are in households, try to negotiate how formalized roles and compensations between partners, between who's involved in the household. Now, this sort of conversation should be founded, which I believe should be founded in honesty, in humility, and in truth. This might be a hard conversation, right? So it's a hard conversation, even for myself and for most of us. And I know it's easier said than done, but to highlight how important this is. So again, going back to Sharon. Sharon could not access the bank account in James's name. That's not just inconvenient, but it is economic independence. Hers and her children's life depended on it. So if you're asking your partner to do 20 hours weekly work of business work, that's a job. And that's a job that should be contracted, that should be compensated, and should count towards their pension. And for male entrepreneurs especially, recognizing that your success may be built on your partner's invisible labor. Male entrepreneurs must recognize that their success may be built on household extraction system that disadvantages their partner. So ask, when we celebrate your business, are we actually celebrating a household system that disadvantages your partner? Would your work or would your business look like if you had to pay if you had to pay the market rate or for all the labor? If, you know, would it still survive? So for the field entrepreneurship research, for us, we need to change who we interview, who we observe, and what we count. We need to think about how we do data. So if you're only talking to the registered business owners, you're getting a partial story, which I argue, right? So multi-actor households, which is messy, it is complex, it is dynamic, it is hard, it's very, very challenging. I've faced it myself, but it is the only way to see the full socioeconomic system. And we need to stop treating household support as a neutral resource pool. It's structured by gender, it's structured by power and also inequality. So to end us, the practical takeaway is that sustainable business requires sustainable household systems. So the extraction models where one person's success depends on another's unpaid labor are not just unfair, they are fragile. They collapse when household dynamics change, when the invisible workers wants formal employment, when caring responsibility, when they intensify. So recognizing and fairly compensating all labor isn't just ethics. It's what we call good business. So perhaps my final message here is that I would like to encourage our audience who are listening to this podcast to critically reflect on our conversation today and to also continue this necessary conversation with myself and with others. So I do look forward to how it all unfolds. And yes, again, thank you ever so much, Vincent, for your patience, your time, and also for simply just listening to what I have to say.
Thanks a lot, Marie-Joy, for participating to our show and presenting your paper entitled "They Don't Waste the Money on Women: Gendered Entrepreneurial Household Dynamics and the Total Social Organization of Labor." All our podcasts are available on entrepreneurship-ed.com and on the main podcast platforms.